Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Few names in history can still cause extreme response from absolute love to absolute hate. Ask in the name of Leon Trotsky. Trotsky was an original revolutionary in Russia's Revolution of 1917, a close ally of Vladimir Lenin. But after Lenin's death, Trotsky lost the power struggle against Joseph Stalin, and then he was forced to flee and eventually lived in exile in Mexico for a few years, especially the latter years of his life. While fearing constant assassination attempts on his life, Trotsky still had an international following, and perhaps his strongest support came from inside the United States. My guest, Bertrand Patenaut, has written a book about Trotsky's life while in exile. It's called Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary. Bertrand Patenaut is also a lecturer in history and international relations at Stanford University. It is good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Mitch. Thank you.
Well, let's start from the beginning, slightly before the actual Russian, or even during the Russian Revolution and Trotsky's role in it. And in my introduction, I said that Trotsky was a close ally of Lenin, which I think was true, but they weren't ideologically the same. In fact, Trotsky was a Menshevik. So maybe we could begin by talking about what was a Menshevik compared to a Bolshevik and the relationship of Trotsky to Lenin.
Well, this is an interesting backgrounder because Lenin and Trotsky were actually arch enemies for most of the period before the 1917 revolution. The Russian Marxist Party split. It was living in emigration, mostly, for the most part, split into two wings, Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. That was in 1903. I think within a few years, many of the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks sort of forgot what the original split was about. But it really had to do with Lenin's idea that you needed a tight-fisted party, and that members of the party had to be professional revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. Lenin was seen by Trotsky and others as being power hungry and as being a kind of sort of future dictator. And Trotsky, not fair to say that he was a Menshevik, although he originally in 1903 at that party congress lined up with the Mensheviks. Trotsky ends up becoming a kind of free agent. He is a sort of person on his own between the factions, always trying to sort of bring them together. But the key fact is he's not a Bolshevik right up until 1917. Mm. And indeed, in the years just before 1917, he's one of Lenin's most ferocious critics.
Wow. When we talk about Menshevik and Bolshevik, and they're just meanings. Bolshevik is what? Majority. Menshevik is
minority.
That's right.
They took a vote at that Congress in 1903. And the majority, or the majoritarians, Bolsheviki, ended up keeping that name. That's no surprise. The mystery, of course, is why those who were in the minority on that vote, they were later in the majority, but why they decided to keep the name minoritarians. Not very inspiring.
Now, for the starting at the time of the revolution of 1917 anyways, Trotsky becomes a very close ally of Lenin and really forms a very close, tight bond with Lenin.
That's the amazing thing, is that once the Romanov dynasty falls in the first months of 1917, all these revolutionaries rush back to Petrograd, as St. Petersburg was called back then, the revolutionary capital. That's where the Romanovs had lived. That's where the center of the revolution was. And Trotsky actually was in New York City. When the Romanov dynasty fell, he made his way back. He got back a bit later than Lenin. But once he got back, it was very clear to Trotsky that the action was where Lenin was, Lenin's Bolshevik party. And so he joined, and he and Lenin ended up being close allies from that point.
What was Trotsky doing in New York?
Actually, Trotsky had gotten into some trouble and had been kicked out of a couple of European countries, not the last time, yeah. That's what happened. And ended up sailing to New York. And actually, there were other key Russian Marxists living in New York at the time. Nikolai Bukharin was there as well. Later on, a prominent Bolshevik in the 1920s and 30s before he's put to death by Stalin. So Trotsky is way out, far away from the scene of the revolution, and yet he is involved in revolutionary journalism. New York was not a bad place to be at that time, but he certainly made haste to get back to Russia once the Romanov dynasty fell.
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself because I really want to dive in to when New York really became the headquarters of the Trotskyist movement. But was it those early days that helped form that base for him later?
Actually, the 1930s base, the folks that Trotsky would later be associated with, none of those people was on the scene in 1917. But in 1917, there was a kind of emigre colony, and it's those associations that Trotsky would later keep when he got to Russia.
You write about Trotsky's relationship to Lenin and really how seemed like Lenin or Trotsky just fell in love with Lenin, but that wasn't unheard of. That seemed to happen to a lot of people that came in contact with Lenin, which was interesting to me because normally when you think of a leader from the USSR, somebody who's not so charismatic, but it sounds like Lenin doesn't fit that stereotype.
No, in fact, it is a curious thing. I've read quite a few diaries and memoirs of people on the left, including Americans, who said, you know, you could fall in love with Lenin. And I did.
Huh.
Quite a remarkable thing. But there was such a charisma, excuse me, about this man, that there was something very likable about him, as, you know, mean and tough as he could be as a revolutionary leader. And people fell for him, fell hard for him. Trotsky was one of them.
Wow. I also said in my introduction that after Lenin's death, then the power struggle ensued between Trotsky and Joseph Stalin. Is that accurate? And is it as simple as saying that?
I think that captures a lot of it. Just as Trotsky was outside the Bolshevik inner circle in the decade plus up to 1917, Stalin was the consummate organization man. He was the guy, the party organization man that Lenin could rely on, right? And actually, during the Civil War, as I think you know, Trotsky was the creator, organizer of the Red Army and really its leader during this period. This is when he started to clash with Stalin, who was a commissar as part of the Red Army during this period. And you could tell these two people did not like each other, very different backgrounds, of course. So what happens is when Lenin gets ill, and that really begins in 1922, you see the tensions mounting. And it's a power struggle that is much, it's more than Stalin versus Trotsky, but that really becomes the main event. And in fact, it turns out to be no contest. Stalin is underestimated by Trotsky. Trotsky, the man of the masses who could give the great speeches in 1917. The problem for Trotsky was by 1922, the masses had been taken out of the equation, and the fighting was going on in the inner corridors of power, and there Stalin was the master, and Trotsky really couldn't fight his way out of a paper bag, as we would say later on. So it was really no contest.
And Stalin was a bank robber.
Stalin,
this guy was a tough guy.
Stalin had that reputation and that experience in the underground. He was the guy. A lot of the revolutionaries would live in exile abroad. So they'd live in these great capitals. Trotsky was in Vienna for 7 years, loved it there. Stalin preferred to be inside Russia. And one of the jobs he had, of course, was finding loot, getting money for the party organization. And one of the things that they did, what they engaged in, was robbing banks. But he was much more than that. He was a very clever organization man.
And we get to this in Leninism. You have this idea of a, and you with this Trotsky-Stalin split. You have this idea with Leninism of the dictator of the proletariat.
Mm-hmm.
Now we begin sort of this idea of a dictator of the proletariat versus the dictator of the secretariat.
Right. Trotsky actually, it's very interesting when he broke with Lenin. Back in 1903, Bolsheviks, Mensheviks, he has, and it's a famous quote, quoted in the Isaac Deutscher biography of Trotsky, I couldn't resist, I quoted it myself, where Trotsky says, listen, what Lenin wants is a dictatorship of the proletariat, but it will eventually lead to the dictatorship of one man. And by the time the party organization is set up in 1921-22, there is such a thing as a general secretary. And it's that position that Stalin uses to accumulate the power that eventually becomes a personal dictatorship. So Trotsky had foreseen this. He was right about it.
Huh. Again, we are in conversation with Bertrand Pattenaud. He is the author of the book, Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary, also a lecturer in history and international relations at Stanford University. So then Trotsky begins a life of exile, eventually gets to Mexico, which a large part of your book goes into. Why Mexico?
Well, first of all, he loses the battle, and of course, everyone says, well, why didn't Stalin just annihilate Trotsky? In other words, just physically wipe him out back in 1929 instead of letting him go into exile in Turkey. Well, back in 1929, two things were different. First of all, Stalin wasn't hadn't accumulated the power he would have accumulated by the mid-late 1930s when the Great Purge trials took place. And two, the culture of the Bolshevik Party, arresting somebody like Trotsky was a big deal. Executing somebody was still a no-no. Stalin arranges for Trotsky to go into exile in Turkey. Speculation, if Trotsky had stayed in Turkey, he might have lived longer, because the Soviets had a policy of not tampering with Turkey's internal affairs. He wanted to go where the action was, and that was France. He ended up getting there in 1935. But then the French government had its own difficulties, and having Trotsky in the country was becoming politically untenable. So they said, you have to leave. The country that took him was Norway. So Trotsky was there for a better part of a year. But then the Soviet government put pressure on the Norwegian government to hand him over or get rid of him. So at that point, Trotsky had to figure out where to go. No other country in Europe would take him. And of course, that was probably the Kremlin's hope, that the Norwegians would hand him over. But there was one person, one president, and that was President Cárdenas in Mexico, who was a very independent-minded guy. And Cárdenas's associates in the government were big fans of Trotsky. And Diego Rivera, the mural painter, was also considered himself a Trotskyist. And he went to President Cárdenas and said, you've got to give this guy a refuge here. And that is, in fact, what they did toward the end of 1936. Trotsky arrived in the first days of January 1937.
And Lázaro Cárdenas is considered a great Mexican president. I mean, he's kind of their FDR. That was the way, at least I see it.
Lázaro Cárdenas, I must say, somebody who read my book, said that of all the figures, the public officials and leaders, he comes across the best. A man who knows what he's about, goes about doing it, told Trotsky, don't live in hiding. You've got to live your own life. We're going to make this as comfortable as possible for you, stood by his principles. The Mexican Communist Party did not want this to happen. They wanted Trotsky out.
Because they're allied with Stalin.
Exactly. They are Stalinist and meaning loyal to Moscow.
Yeah.
And so Cárdenas really had some stiff resistance, but he said, no, Trotsky will come in. Cárdenas, again, one of the real positive figures in the book.
And of course, during FDR's reign, they didn't allow Trotsky into the country. So
The United States?
United States, yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, when I compared Cárdenas to FDR, I just want to make that distinction.
Oh, yeah, and not that Trotsky didn't want to get into the United States. He tried a few times. One time thought he would get in to testify about communism before a congressional committee. State Department nixed that idea. He never got in.
Now, when Trotsky gets to Mexico, the beginning of 1937, this is 20 years after the 1917 Russian Revolution. It's also 20 years after the end of the Mexican Revolution, when we get such revolutionary heroes as Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa. A connection there, do you think?
I think that...
That allowed for Trotsky to come to Mexico?
I think that Cárdenas and the political culture, communists aside, in Mexico respected a great revolutionary, and everyone knew, unless you had those ideological blinders on, that Trotsky was a great revolutionary. Maybe he didn't have the model of how to move forward for all of these people, but he's somebody whose great October socialist revolution, and Trotsky's role in that was considerable, was respected in Mexico.
there was always a threat of assassination against Trotsky. Eventually, he was assassinated in Mexico. We'll get to that, but not yet. But in that, you also during this period, you have the Soviet Union begin not actually putting Trotsky on trial, but his supporters and his associates started going on trial.
Yes, and there were three great Moscow trials, so-called show trials, because they were, in fact, put on, open to the public and foreign diplomats and others. The first one had been in August 1936, so Trotsky was in Norway, and no one could believe what they were hearing. The chief defendants were Trotsky's allies, or had been. Trotsky himself was portrayed as the mastermind of all the plots that were described: assassination, wrecking, sabotage. I mean, the most outrageous charges. So really, Trotsky was put on trial in absentia, one could say, and condemned to death, because all of the defendants were condemned after that trial. Then, as soon as Trotsky arrived, within a couple of weeks after his arrival, the second Moscow trial began. Once again, it was Trotsky who was portrayed as the mastermind. You see, having him abroad, people originally thought Stalin must really have kicked himself for letting Trotsky go. However, having Trotsky living abroad enabled Stalin to portray him as the great evil mastermind that was cooking up all these plots. He was a perfect foil and somebody they could really play on, and they did over and over again. So the second trial was in January 1937, and then the final trial, known as the Great Purge Trial, Nikolai Bukharin came up in the dock on that one. That was March 1938. And by then, this wasn't Trotskyists anymore. This wasn't the entire Bolshevik establishment. The people who had made the revolution with Lenin, they were being wiped out.
With Lenin.
Back in 1917.
At the same time, you have a hearing in Mexico put on by mostly Trotsky's supporters in order to try to counterbalance the news that was coming out of the Soviet Union. Interestingly enough, a lot of people at the time, a lot of press were sympathetic to the Soviet Union and their betrayal of Trotsky. The Nation magazine, the New York Times. So in Mexico, in the house, and that Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo were allowing the Trotsky and his wife to live at, they have their own hearing about the allegations.
Well, that's true. Trotsky moved into, Diego and Frida weren't living in the so-called Blue House, but this is actually where Frida grew up. Oh. And Diego ended up buying the house, and they lived there for a while, but they weren't living there. Trotsky and wife Natalia, who accompanied him to Mexico, were allowed to live there. And as soon as Trotsky got organized and sort of acclimated, the idea among his supporters, and believe me, the idea was brewing in the United States, in liberal and left circles, most people, you're right, believed what was happening in Moscow. I mean, as crazy as it looks today, you know, poisonings and attempted assassination and wrecking and sabotage, and, you know, there was the notion that Trotskyists were in league with Hitler and with the Japanese government. It seems absurd today, but you're right. Most of the mainstream publications believed it. And it was in certain circles on the left and among Trotsky's followers, but also certain independent-minded types thought that they ought to put these hearings to the test. And so what they did was they decided to organize a counter trial, in a way, hearings that would take place in Mexico and also in New York. Trotsky would be interviewed, and they would pull the evidence together. They'd look at the charges in Moscow and see if those charges were proved or not proved. Well, Trotsky was keen to have a great public figure in America sort of chair these proceedings, and he succeeded in the sense that his followers persuaded John Dewey, the great philosopher, educational reformer, at the time, public intellectual, maybe the first such public intellectual in American history, to chair the proceedings. Dewey came to Mexico. He brought a few of the commission members with him, a so-called subcommission. They were there a week. They interviewed Trotsky. They interviewed some of his comrades. Very dramatic. Anyway, it took several more months to interview others in New York and to look at all the documents from Moscow. And late in 37, Trotsky was exuberant because the Dewey Commission verdict was not guilty. In other words, the charges against Trotsky in Moscow had not been proved. This was, for Trotsky, a great propaganda victory.
Was it well covered?
Oh, it was massive coverage at the time. The New York Times covered it in a very big way. I mean, already you could feel by December 37 that certain mainstream commentators were getting the point that something was wrong about the Moscow trials, and people were pulling back from an outright endorsement. But Dewey was on the radio. He was interviewed in the press. And, I mean, he said not guilty. What he also said infuriated Trotsky. He also said now is not the time to be jumping on board with Trotsky and his principles. Communism was not the way. Certainly fascism wasn't the way. But we had to find a sort of, you know, our own way. And that was a sort of liberal democratic way. Trotsky was very angry when he heard that. He thought it diluted the message, but he kept quiet about it and did not engage in polemics at that time with Dewey.
I think an important point to remember here, when we talk about Trotsky, he was against Stalin, but he was not against the USSR. And I'm talking about here what is dubbed the Russian question.
That's right. And this becomes actually very controversial late in the 30s when so many people look at the trials and they begin to feel that the USSR is no longer worth backing. And especially after the Nazi-Soviet pact, August 23rd, 1939, there were a lot of Americans, the New York intellectuals, who were, if not Communist Party members, then fellow travelers of Moscow, and they looked at this and said, that's it. It's all over. How could we back this regime? Trotsky's idea, all the way to the end of his life, which came in August 1940, was that the Soviet Union was still a worker state. The October Revolution had caused a social revolution in Russia, and all that Stalin did was to kind of hijack that revolution and to impose a dictatorial bureaucracy on it, right? So in Trotsky's view, it was a worker state. It was a degenerated worker state, but it was still salvageable.
It was still a worker state.
It was still a worker state.
The revolution lived on.
And the revolution lived on. And all we needed to do was to form a rival international to the Third International. The Soviet Union was the head of that international. And thus Trotsky, while he was in Mexico, engineered the formation of the Fourth International. Still exists, by the way, out there. At the time, it was seen as the great alternative to Moscow. And Trotsky's hope was that the Fourth International would unite parties around the world, and that when war came, which he knew it would, that somehow
World War II,
the upheaval of World War II would allow him, just as in World War I the Bolsheviks had come to power, would allow him to ride that revolutionary wave right into power in the Kremlin and restore workers' democracy to the October Revolution, to the Soviet Union.
Where was the First International then?
The First International is associated with Karl Marx. Back, you know, in the 1860s. And actually, the First International gets blamed for the Paris Commune, which is just ridiculous nonsense. But nonetheless, Marx didn't mind that association. And that one was a very modest affair by the standards of what is to come. The Second International is a socialist international formed before World War One by the socialist, social democratic parties on the left. And that comes really crashing down when World War One breaks out, because the socialists ended up becoming nationalists, taking sides in the war. And really, the Second International just collapses. The Third International is formed by Lenin's regime in Moscow. They had moved from Petersburg to Moscow. They had moved the capital starting in 1918 and starting in 1919. And this is seen to be the successor to the Second International, and of course will lead to worldwide revolution. This is the Third International and the conventions in Moscow. That's where John Reed comes in, mm-hmm. and other Americans who go there.
The movie Reds was based off of,
yes,
Warren Beatty.
Exactly right. And John
Ten
Reed,
Days That Shook the World.
Ten Days That Shook the World. He writes based on seeing the events of 1917. That's John mm-hmm. Reed. And then Reed attends especially the Second Congress of the Comintern in 1920. And of course, as Warren Beatty's Reds illustrates, he becomes disillusioned with the communist experiment, eventually contracts typhus and dies and is buried still.
The only American.
The only American in the Kremlin wall. That's exactly right. That's a little detour. But anyway, that was the Third International. And then Trotsky said, and he held out a long time from doing this. Trotsky said the Third International is now completely corrupted by the late 1930s, and so we need to form a Fourth International. And that was his great cause in the last couple of years before he died.
And it gets back to this issue that we mentioned earlier, the dictator of the proletariat versus the dictator of the secretariat. I mean, that's sort of the heart of this, the conflict between Stalin and Trotsky.
Well, that's from Trotsky's point of view. Trotsky says, look, the dictatorship of the proletariat was meant to be the dictatorship of the working class. And what happened is you had a bureaucracy. Stalin, by the way, was not an impressive figure in Trotsky's mind. Stalin merely was the embodiment of the of this impersonal bureaucracy. And this bureaucracy, sort of parasitic bureaucracy, grafted itself onto the workers' state, and workers' democracy came to an end. So in Trotsky's mind, yes, we had a dictatorship of the secretariat and of Stalin, but really it was a bureaucratic stratum up at the very top that was suffocating workers' democracy. We needed to go back to the original ideals of October. He was criticized, of course, and said, well, you didn't support workers' democracy in the good years, your salad days of 1917, 18, 1920, only when you were reeling in defeat or in exile did you support democracy. And he said, nonetheless, that's what we need now. We need to get Stalin out of power.
What was the Communist League of America?
Communist League of America, actually, in the early 1930s, a group of communists who were sympathetic to Trotsky, and that becomes the core of what will later become the Trotskyist Party, formed in 1938, centered in New York City.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in the earlier days, it was Paris that Trotsky was really counting on. But of course, by the late 1930s, the politics in Paris get very precarious. And then after World War II begins and France is invaded, there's no way to communicate with Paris. Paris will fall. And even before then, what you saw and what Trotsky saw was that the real strength, the real roots that the Trotskyists were putting down were in the United States.
Yeah.
The brains of the movement, of the outfit, were in New York. And Trotsky banked everything on this now. He had to. Paris was knocked out. And around the world, the Trotskyist parties were not really, almost not even parties. They were groupings or grouplets. And even those things tended to split into factions because the Trotskyists couldn't get along.
Welcome to the left.
Welcome to the left. And of course, what will agonize Trotsky in the last year and a half of his life is that the American Trotskyists indeed split into two groups. And it's over the issue of whether the USSR should really be considered a worker state. Trotsky supports James Cannon and the majority against the minority led by Max Schachtman and James Burnham. Burnham will soon leave the party entirely, and Shachtman will hang on for a while.
Burnham goes to the right.
And Burnham goes hard right, ends up at National Review with William F. Buckley in the 1950s.
Is that the link to Trotskyism and neoconservative?
Actually, because it's one of the links that shows you that hard left can go hard right pretty quickly. National Review was never really neoconservative. No. But many of the people who were either Trotskyists or sympathetic to Trotsky, and they might have been at New York University or anywhere basically in the New York vicinity, several of those people end up drifting to the Democratic Party and then neoconservative wing, and then they become full-blown neocons.
Yeah.
They've got Trotskyist roots. There's no getting around it.
Someone like Irving Kristol?
Irving Kristol is a very good example. The others out there, Daniel Bell, Irving Howe, Nathan Glazer, I talk about this in my book. These are people who, if not outright Trotskyists, were very sympathetic to Trotsky's cause because Trotsky was seen as the great alternative to Moscow.
Yeah.
And if you still wanted to hold on to the notion of the great October Socialist Revolution, but you didn't want to be associated with Stalinism, Trotsky was the way to go. What happened, the problem for Trotsky, is that as the war breaks out, and especially as the Soviet Union aligns with Nazi Germany, a lot of people thought the whole experiment was bankrupt, and the Soviet experiment, and that it had really bankrupted itself, and there was nothing left of a worker state. Trotsky insisted that it was a worker state right to the end, and his party in New York, his Trotskyist party, split in two. And he was distraught about this. And to the end of his life, he was arguing with the minority and toward the very end, calling them renegades and saying they should come back to the fold and support the Soviet Union.
Tell me more about the dynamic between James Cannon and Max Shachtman.
Well, two very different types.
And this is a leftist split here, unlike when we talked about James Burnham, who went far to the right. Now we're talking factionalism within the left.
Within the left, that's right. Cannon was, I would say, more sort of had an easier time associated with the working class. And he, in the 1920s, fought some great battles, including in Moscow and among the Communist Party, and was among the founders of the first Trotskyist Party. Max Shachtman, more the intellectual, had a sort of a mind of his own, more willing to question Trotsky. And so by the mid-30s, Shachtman, and I must say that he was galvanized oftentimes by Burnham, who could be a real troublemaker, intellectually. And Shachtman was more inclined to question what Trotsky would say. Cannon was more likely to take it as the sort of theological certainty that he wanted all the other comrades to take it as. So when push came to shove in 1939, and the party split after the formal split comes in early 1940, but it's Cannon who is very hard-headed about how we have to line up behind the old man, as they sympathetically call Trotsky. And it's Shachtman who finally said, I can't do this. This is supporting the Soviet Union after all this and calling it a worker state. It in no way resembles a worker state. I can't do this. That was the core of the split.
And the final straw was when Trotsky, which is amazing to think, is split with Joseph Stalin and the way he would still defend the USSR when he defended the USSR's invasion of Finland.
Yes, this was first of all, you get the pact, and Trotsky says, okay, we predicted this, and he had predicted that.
The Nazi-Soviet pact.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Or the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939. Then comes the invasion of Poland, and the Soviets wait a couple of weeks, and on September 17, they invade eastern Poland. This was part of the pact. It wasn't public, but this was part of the pact. So they divide Poland in two, and then the Soviets begin to lean on the Baltic states to basically roll over and let the Soviets take over those countries and install military bases there. And then they leaned on the Finns. Well, December 1939, the Finns say no. And a war breaks out, the so-called Winter War. And in fact, the Red Army did very poorly in this. And at first, the Finns gave the Red Army a bloody nose.
Yeah.
And the comrades in New York looked to Trotsky.
The Finns were skiing around. Their army skied.
In the snow. This was the Winter War, and they knew the terrain better, and they were holding out very well. Well, Trotsky was trying to argue to the comrades that, in fact, in Poland, the invading Red Army was bringing socialism with it. There was, even though we didn't have news reports at the time telling us what was going on, the imaginations of most of the New York comrades said, boy, bringing socialism, this is hard to imagine. But it was the Finnish War and the Soviet attempt to take over Finland that really, I think, was the final straw, as you called it. And several of the New York comrades, Shachtman and Burnham leading the way, said, this demonstrates that this is imperialism and that the Moscow regime does not represent a workers' state. End of the story.
Bertrand Pattenaud, as we move to wrap up here, it's fascinating to me, this history. You see the factionalism from the split between Stalin and Trotsky, the split amongst Trotskyists, and how this continues onward. Today, and I think it's very indicative of just generally what I've experienced in the left and factionalism. Today, it's easy to hear somebody call someone a Trotskyist or a Stalinist, if you will, or an anarchist or whatever it is. But when I hear somebody call somebody else a Trotskyist, I've always scratched my head and tried to really figure out what they mean. Do you have any idea what that means?
Well, it's interesting. It's one of these terms. When somebody says someone's a Stalinist, you know they're basically saying he's being a brutal dictator or he's supporting brutal dictatorship. Uh-huh. And that's just basically a way to say you're like a Nazi or something. But when someone says Trotskyist, then that really grabs your attention. What does he mean by that, right? Well, if you think about people, if it's said about people like, well, Christopher Hitchens and even David Brooks, who columnist
David
for
Brooks.
The New York Times. Yes, David Brooks.
A conservative.
A conservative now, but back in the day, you see, in the late 60s, early 70s, when people like Hitchens and David Brooks were coming of age, they were really sort of swept up in the youth, culture, youth movement. And the countercultural, I should say, movement. And it's in that period of time, that sort of late 60s, early 70s, that if Mao doesn't make a comeback or Mao doesn't sort of step up and become the hero of some people on the left, on the new left, it tended to be people like Trotsky and even Lenin.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that if, that Trotsky was still the great hope, that in other words, had the revolution followed his path and not Stalin's, that things might have turned out differently. And so you get, look, I was in college in the early 70s. I had posters of Lenin and Trotsky on my dormitory room wall. It wasn't a serious thing, but there were people who were sort of serious about reading Trotsky's books and the Isaac Deutscher biography, etc. Well, for some people, like it was dabbling, like maybe David Brooks. For Christopher Hitchens, for a long time, he considered himself a Trotskyist. I don't know what he meant by that, but it meant that you were, as Adam Gopnik, the New Yorker writer, said a few years ago, still left and not leaving.
Still left.
I thought it was a nice phrase.
There's also a stereotype, I think, of somebody that Trotskyist believed in. What, infiltrating organizations and trying to take them over?
I've heard this, but saying someone's a Trotskyist, I think there's only one characteristic of Trotskyists that really it's hard to argue with, and that's their penchant for splitting into little smaller and smaller factions.
Yeah.
Whenever you find two or more Trotskyists, maybe it was Irving Howe who once said this, they'll eventually split over something. And that was the problem of the Fourth International. Hmm. Because the Trotskyist groups kept splitting and splitting and splitting. And today, I mean, even today, usually when we talk about the sort of post-World War II Trotskyism, it's sort of 60s and 70s. But even today, you have people who call themselves Trotskyists and others who call themselves Trotskyists, and you couldn't put them in the same room.
Yeah.
That's the problem here.
And you said earlier the Fourth International still exists.
I believe there are quote-unquote Trotskyists, yeah, who still claim to uphold and to carry on the tradition of the Fourth International. You'd have to Google it. But I think that's true.
Bertrand Putnam, I thank you.
My pleasure, Mitch. Thanks.